Good evening and welcome to Project JFK CSI Dallas' presentation of The Journey, On the Trail of the Truth and the JFK Assassination. I'm your host, David Knight, and along with my co-directors, Casey Quillen and Brian Edwards, we want to thank you for attending tonight's special presentation. We want to encourage everyone to visit our website, projectjfk.com, and see what we have to offer the research community. You will find photos, videos, and other research materials not posted on any other website related to the Kennedy assassination. Our site is constantly being updated, and new items are being added weekly. Our site is free to visit, and the information is available for you to enjoy. If you wish to support our cause, there is a donate button on our homepage, and you are free to make a donation if you wish. We are not a nonprofit organization, and the donations help us to update the website with groundbreaking research. Your donations also help sponsor programs like what you're going to experience tonight. So click the donate button and help us continue to search for the truth. Before we begin, we want to mention the ground rules for tonight's presentation. There are portions of tonight's presentation which Dr. Newman has pre-recorded. After part one, we will stop the pre-recorded portion of the presentation, and we will have approximately 25 to 30 minutes for Q&A. Please keep your microphones on mute during the presentation and during the Q&A portion. The chat feature has been disabled, and your questions will be directed to me, which I will forward to Dr. Newman. Please limit your questions to the sections of Dr. Newman's presentation that are presented prior to each live portion of our meeting. Please stay on topic and keep your questions short and to the point to allow others to ask their questions. Some questions may not be submitted to Dr. Newman and asked because of time constraints. Please be respectful to your fellow attendees so everyone can enjoy the meeting. Anyone in attendance that do not follow the guidelines and code of conduct may be ejected from the meeting and possibly may not be admitted back in. This is our first meeting in our new format that will now be known as our Spotlight Series. These events will focus on one keynote speaker giving their presentation, and I cannot think of anyone better to kick off this exciting new series than our special guest, Dr. John Newman. Dr. John Newman is an adjunct professor of political science at James Madison University. He is a retired U.S. Army intelligence officer who served as a strategic intelligence cryptologic analyst before accepting a special two-year appointment to become military assistant to the Director General William Odom at the National Security Agency. Dr. Newman's work as a historian of consequence has overturned orthodoxies, broken new ground, and introduced new facts about America during the Cold War. He has written several books, in particular, JFK in Vietnam, Oswald and the CIA, Where Angels Tread Lightly, The Assassination of JFK Volume 1, Countdown to Darkness, The Assassination of JFK Volume 2, Into the Storm, The Assassination of JFK Volume 3, and his upcoming book, Armageddon, The Assassination of JFK Volume 4. Tonight, Dr. Newman's preview of Volume 4, Armageddon, is not about a standalone book. It is the end product of a work in progress that began 11 years ago, when he decided to go back to the beginning for a fresh start. In his three successive works so far, Dr. Newman has discarded a large number of false pieces from the puzzle of JFK's presidency and assassination. At the same time, he has added lost pieces that have one by one broken new ground and overturned unworkable orthodoxies. Dr. Newman's rigorous methodology has exposed the wizard behind the curtain and his cover and deception operations that have for so long concealed a clear picture of this dystopian war puzzle. And with that, it is my pleasure to introduce Dr. John Newman.
Thank you. I want to express my appreciation to Casey Quinlan, Brian Edwards, and David Knight for inviting me to make this presentation today and tomorrow. It's a pleasure to be working once again with the Project JFK CSI Dallas team. As David mentioned, this venue is not a discussion format. It's a spotlight format. And because of the large audience registered for the event and the breadth of material, I want to thank David for working diligently to adjust the Zoom software settings in order for the audience to experience the maximum benefit of our spotlight format. And I'm not going to repeat some of the things that David said. I'll just add, if the questions you send to David follow the format rules that he has posted and discussed already, he will put them to me. I want to acknowledge now the significant support and work that my longtime research associates, Jay Harvey and Alan Dale, have provided for this presentation. I want to especially acknowledge the superb effort of the new additions to my research team, Heather Fear and Douglas Horn. Heather did a great job editing grammar and punctuation But moreover, she put in a tremendous amount of great work on transcribing the large number of recollections that former Operation Gladio participants provided on camera. You'll be seeing some of them tonight. Doug Horn provided super work on military matters, and especially sharing his extensive expertise on nuclear weapons, doctrine, and strategy. Time is precious, so let's get right to it. David, let her rip.
Okay, Dr. Newman, we're going to share the screen and start the video.
This is section one of an eight-section presentation, which will cover all the way from 1940 up to the, end of 1962 in the Kennedy presidency. In this section, I'll begin with a short preface, and then I will work through part one, or section one, actually. And I will be doing these sections and parts basically when I say 10,000 feet from 10,000 feet above. This is the high altitude, low resolution presentation that is best, I think, for these virtual presentations where you're covering a lot of time, but actually in real time only an hour or two, and we'll have two. Anyway, let me get started with a preface. It's a sort of an aperitif, an hors d'oeuvre. In November 1942, Alan Dulles became the chief of the Office of Strategic Services stationed in Bern, Switzerland. And there, 18 months before the Allied invasion in Normandy, 18 months before then, Dulles made an extraordinary claim to the Office of Strategic Services Chief William Dolivan. We're fighting the wrong enemy. He actually said that. Senior Nazi SS leaders were seeking a separate peace deal with the United States. And in his communiques with Donovan, Dulles endorsed the Nazi proposal. He said Germany's help was needed to check the communist threat from the USSR. In section three of this preview, I will show you how Dulles was protecting U.S. traders who were financing Hitler's war machine while American soldiers were dying on the battlefields of World War II. And one more thing before moving along to section one. And in conjunction with what Dulles was up to during the war, brothers John and Alan Dulles were partners in Sullivan and Cromwell along with the Brown brothers Harriman. These two were the most powerful Wall Street firms aiding the Nazis the most. To President Roosevelt, this constituted treason. The key for the Nazi activities of Averell Harriman and Prescott Bush was the Nazi Kurt von Schroeder, head of the German J.H. Stein Bank and a very close associate of the Dulles brothers. Bush's shipping lines subsidized Nazi propaganda in America and smuggled Nazi spies into the U.S. even after the war after America had entered the war. In 1944, Schroeder was the outlet for the International Telephone and Telegraph Company money funneled to the SS chief Heinrich Himmler, Hitler's SS domestic paramilitary security entity, while the United States was at war with Germany during World War II. Bush hired Alan Dulles to hide his Nazi secrets. Standard Oil was another Dulles client hired to cloak its activities. Alan Dulles found out that Naval Officer Richard Nixon had been put in charge of captured Nazi documents revealing that he, Dulles, was a traitor. So Dulles financed Nixon's first race for office in exchange for burying those documents. Anyway, I'll stop now. This is just a taste of what's coming in Section 3. And just adds another sad and really disturbing part to what happened in World War II, especially in Europe. Now, this entire briefing this evening is really comes out of two chapters 3 and 4 in Armageddon, Volume 4. And chapter three, which is going to take up a lot of what I'm going to talk about, is just covering World War II from 1940 to 45. A lot goes on there. The battles for North Africa, Italy, and Western Europe. Chapter four is going to go from the end of the war, from 1945 all the way up to just to the end of 62 or early 63. They'll be talking about the stay behind nets, the rise of NATO and Gladio, and the history of U.S. military and intelligence organizations. Within those, the material from those two chapters, they will be context for actually tracking a cast of characters from 1940 all the way up to the end of 62, early 63, that end up taking over everything during the Kennedy years. And I've selected several military officers, Generals Lemitzer, Taylor, Birkenall, and Colonel Howard Burris, and then selected a number of intelligence officers we want to follow, Alan Dulles, Richard Helms, James Angleton, and maybe a couple others. So that's my plan. And for those of you who want to come back and look at this more seriously, here is a table of contents that I don't need to run through right now, but that's basically the order of battle that I'm going to be going through this evening. So here we go, part one of this presentation is on selected military officers in World War II. I'll begin with General Maxwell Taylor. He's for sure going to be in our crosshairs when we get into the Kennedy administration, a long ways away from World War II. He was an Army major when he served under General Eisenhower on the War Plans Division staff in 1940 and rose rapidly to Brigadier General in 1942 as the Chief of Staff of the 82nd Airborne Division. He served under Eisenhower in Operations Torch in North Africa and Avalanche in Sicily and Italy. Taylor replaced General Lee, who died of a heart attack, as the commander of the 101st Airborne Division with the rank of Major General during the Allied invasion at Normandy. So for him, you know, wanting to get a position, you know, in World War II, that was a lucky break and not so good for the general who died. The 101st Airborne participated in the largest airborne operation in World War II, Operation Market Garden in Arnhem in September, and the relief of U.S. forces at the Battle of the Bulge in Bastogne in December. Germany surrendered on 7 May 1945. The plans to send the 101st to the Pacific theater were scuttled when, after the nuclear bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan formally surrendered on 2 September 1945. At that point, General Taylor was then reassigned as the superintendent of West Point, and we'll pick up his story downstream. In 1935, General Lemitzer, he's another guy we're going to really be following all the way through. He's like Forrest Gump. He shows up just about everywhere that it's important in our story. Anyway, in 1935, he became the chief of Eisenhower's War Plans Division in the Pentagon. In 1942, Lemitzer became Eisenhower's assistant chief of staff for operations during Operation Torch, the Allied invasion of French North Africa, from 8 to 10 November 1942, and commanded by Eisenhower. Stalin and Nazi leaders had caught wind of the secret OSS Nazi peace plan, and as a result, that plan languished for 3 years until the end of 1945, at which point Lemitzer is going to get heavily involved in it. And we'll get to that shortly. During 1942 to 1945, Dulles and Lemitzer colluded with Churchill Alan Dulles, and Lemitzer colluded against Roosevelt for a strong post-war Germany to check the USSR in Europe. And that collusion presaged their collusion against JFK in 61 and 62. Anyway, by February 1945, Lemitzer had become the protege and deputy chief of staff for British General Harold Alexander, supreme Allied commander of the Mediterranean Theater of Operations. Lemitzer played the key role in one of the most celebrated cloak and dagger missions of the war, Operation Sunrise. In February of 1945, the secret OSS Nazi plan for the surrender of the 26 Nazi divisions in Italy was on again. British General Alexander sent his deputy chief of staff, Lemnitzer, to handle the sensitive negotiations with the Nazi German, Nazi general, Karl Otto Wolff, for a secret German surrender of a million German troops in northern Italy. Once again, though, obstacles delayed the deal when Hitler and several SS officers again got found out about it. Hauled before Hitler, Wolff pleaded his case, and a feeble Führer at that point ordered him to negotiate for something better. Hitler committed suicide soon after in his Berlin bunker on 30 April. The secret Nazi surrender in Italy was finally done on 2 May at Caserta, the headquarters of Field Marshal Alexander, whose mentor is the one who composed that surrender memorandum, more or less out of whole cloth. Lemnitzer wrote it. He showed it to General Alexander for his approval, and it took place 6 days later on 8 May. Well, actually, the total surrender took place then, a few days after the surrender at Caserta. Moving along to another guy we're going to be tracking well through all the years is Curtis LeMay. Fascinating character and another person who ended up having basically being a legend in his own mind. In his autobiography in 1968, he declared America is in danger. And he said the thing that worried him most was his quarrel with politicians who usurp the military professional's position, those who step in front of him and who volunteer and enforce strictly military guidance with very little knowledge or of experience in such matters. He's particularly angry with Kennedy on those grounds. Anyway, let's take a look. In 1929, LeMay studied civil engineering at Ohio State University, and he joined the U.S. Army Air Corps. It was that point there was no Air Force independent of the Army. That was the precursor to the Air Force. He had risen to that rank of major by the time of Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor in December 1941. During World War II, LeMay commanded the 305th Operations Group from October 42 to September 43 and the 3rd Air Division in the European Theater until August 1944. We most often think of his work in the Pacific, which we'll go over, but there was a fairly important component in Europe before that. LeMay pioneered flying formations and bombing procedures that became the standard operating procedures in the 8th Air Force. He was later transferred to the China-Burma-India Theater and took command of strategic bombing operations against Japan. LeMay planned and executed a massive firebombing campaign against Japanese cities and Operation Starvation, which was a crippling mine-laying campaign in Japan's internal waterways. Another guy who's been overlooked, I think, by most people researching the Kennedy case, even those that aren't, chained to the, what I like to call, ingest sometimes, the Dealey Plaza water cooler. Those who do even go back in history have really overlooked this guy. And you'll see why as we move through, just not just tonight, but when you get the copy of my book at the end of the year. David Birkenall was born in Pennsylvania in 1915. He received a BA in 1938 from Brown University and entered pilot training at Randolph Field, Texas in June 39. He graduated in 1940 with his pilot's wings and was commissioned as a second lieutenant. Birkenall became the A3, that's operations, deputy chief of staff for operations for the 313th Bombardment Wing based in Tinian, Northern Marianas, very important place. And to get you close enough where you can fly to Japan without having to refuel. In 1945, he became the A3 for LeMay's 20th Air Force on Guam. Now, in an interesting interview with Lieutenant General Greenleaf, at the time retired United States Air Force officer, Larry Happenin, who many of you might know, does great work on military aspects of the case surrounding the Kennedy story. Happened to discover that Birkenall was a protege of LeMay. His task for years was actually to speak for LeMay in his absence at the Strategic Air Command and later at the Pentagon when he moved on to higher positions, like Chief of Staff of the Air, you know, of the Air Force and Joint Chiefs of Staff. LeMay and Birkenau became very close and were of a like mind. When Birkenau arrived at Tinian Island, his unit joined the 21st Bomber Command led by LeMay. That was the start of a long, close relationship between the two men. Birkenau immediately flew several bombing missions. On 25 February 1945, he flew the lead bomber of 231 B-29s on an early incendiary raid to Tokyo. The success of this try led to the decision to do do lots of low-level night fire raids on cities all over Japan. But Birkenau did not fly on those later missions because LeMay liked him so much, he transferred him to his headquarters to be an operations planner. LeMay instituted a series of these new tactics in massed formations throughout the length and breadth of Japan. These firebombings. For Birkenau, these new tactics signaled that the victory in the Pacific was near. Anyway, note here that in volume four, again, I will be having a lot more to say about Birkenau that is very important to how things turn out in Dallas, Texas in 1963. And then the last guy I want to talk about is military officers, never made it to general. He made it to colonel. He was in intelligence. So he wasn't in the op side of the house, and that's probably why he never got beyond colonel. He really didn't want to anyway. Howard Leigh Burris was born on 26 April 1918 in Texas. In 1946, he married Barbara Jester, the daughter of Beaufort Jester, who became governor of Texas that year. In 1976, Burris's son, Howard Jr., married Shahrazad Palban, a niece of the Shah of Iran, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. In 1938, 4 years before America entered World War II in Europe, Burris was appointed to the U.S. Military Academy at West Point by the owner of the King Ranch, who also happened to be Burris's congressman, Richard Mifflin Kleberg, Sr. of the Texas 14th Congressional District. Burris graduated with the West Point class of 1942 with an engineering degree, BS engineering degree. And after West Point, he was assigned to the U.S. Army Air Forces. In two combat tours, 1943 to 1945, he commanded 176 B-26 bomber missions in England, France, Germany, and Belgium. He received two Distinguished Flying Crosses, 14 Air Medals, 2 Purple Hearts, 7 Service Medals, 9 campaign citations, and a presidential citation. Now, all of that is true and very good, but I just want to drop something on you here at the very end to alert you that not everything Burris was doing was good and true. In 1991 interviews with me, Burris told me that his family and Lyndon Johnson's family went way back. And that one day when Burris was on an oil rig, LBJ approached him and ordered him to join the war going on in Europe. At the time of that interview, I had no reason to think Burris was embellishing his story, but my research over the past two decades suggests otherwise. First, it looks like Burris's congressman, by the way, had more to do with his entry into the armed forces than LBJ. As we will see below, one must note not only what Burris says, but also what he leaves out. I'll give you one example. Let me make sure that we're live. Yes. So Burris claims that the day of JFK's murder, he had been asked by Johnson to go down to the ranch and for a briefing on some documents. Anyway, after the assassination, he was told to get back to Washington, D.C. real quick. So he claims that after JFK's murder, he piloted an Air Force jet calmly after the pilot died to safety in D.C. He'd never flown a fighter jet, by the way. Those were turboprops that he had done. But anyway, He takes over the aircraft with a dead pilot in the front seat, flies it, you know, without any problems at all, and lands it safely at in Washington, D.C., in the Capitol. The problem with this is that I did a lot of research on him down at the LBJ Library, and I went through, among other things, is all of his travel vouchers. And there it is. There's a picture of one over there. And if you blow this thing up, you'll see what it says there. That day, he wasn't in any jet with a dead pilot in it. He traveled back to Washington, D.C. as a tourist, the tourist class, even Brandup Airlines. So what we take away from this, before we move on here, is that much more was going on behind the scenes of Burris' stories before and during Kennedy's presidency. We're moving along now to section two. And section two has three parts, 2A, 2B, and 2C. After a short preview of all three, I'll turn to 2A. This is a quick overview of all three parts. Part two surveys a real Dantean drama, U.S. and British agents jumping behind Nazi lines in Europe. This guerrilla warfare involved espionage, sabotage, and intelligence actions carried out by the British Special Operations Executive, SOE, and the American Office of Strategic Services, OSS. So SOE operations got an early start in 1940, 2 years ahead of OSS operations there, due to the lingering legacy of isolationism in the U.S. The harrowing sacrifices made by SOE and OSS agents, many of whom never returned, were a huge help to the Allied armies in World War II. Now I'll move along to part 2A. The SOE stayed behind services in World War II. The British Special Operations Executive. The British Special Operations Executive, sometimes referred to as Churchill's Secret Army, was an independent British Secret Service created in July 1940 and disbanded in January 1946. It was placed under the Minister of Economic Warfare, Hugh Dalton, and the Secret Intelligence Service, SIS, or more often referred to as MI6, whom Churchill had ordered to set Europe ablaze. The SOE worked to help resistance in Nazi-occupied countries, small at first, as Churchill and the SOE were aware that sabotage might trigger savage reprisals. Special Operations Executive tried to establish a fifth column of trained agents to carry out sabotage wherever the British were able to invade. The forming of Churchill's coalition government in mid-May 1940, the evacuation of most of the British Expeditionary Force from Dunkirk by 4 June, and the French surrender on the 22nd were all reasons for a complete rebuilding of British strategy and the British war machine. Consequently, the Special Operations Executive's approach to armed activity in France was tentative and slow. SOE's objectives included discovering where spontaneous outbursts of national fury at Nazi rule were, encouraging them when they were feeble, and arming them as they grew, and coaxing them when they were strong enough into the areas of greatest common advantage to the Allies. Early during this rebuilding, the relevant intelligence subdepartments were fused together to form the Special Operations Executive. One of them was soon detached again as the Political Warfare Executive, PWE. The SOE chief was General Colin Gubbins. He was headquartered at 64 Baker Street in London. The Baker Street Irregulars, as they came to be known, were trained in sabotage, small arms, radio and telegraph communication, and unarmed combat. SOE agents were also required to be fluent in the language of the nation in which they would be inserted so that they could fit into the society seamlessly. If their presence aroused undue suspicion, their missions could well be over before they even began. Britain knew the irregular war required irregular warriors. Women proved to be invaluable as couriers, spies, saboteurs, and radio operators in the field. They received the same training as the men, some of whom balked at the idea of, God forbid, of sending women behind enemy lines. But female spies would have distinct advantages over the men on the ground. Gender stereotypes also helped keep the women above suspicion. Women were not just viable, they were critical to SOE mission success. Female spies were successful because they learned to be inconspicuous. They had secret identities, went on secret missions, and were trusted with their nation's greatest secrets. 39 of the 470 SOE agents in France were women, with an additional 16 deployed to other areas. The stories of the SOE's irregular women transcend male and female. They are human stories of daring, courage, and sacrifice. At the paramilitary schools, the courses included physical training, silent killing, weapons handling, demolition, map reading, compass work, field craft, elementary Morse code, raid tactics, and parachute jumping, of course. The SOE had a list of plastic surgeons who could alter the features of agents whose cover had been blown so they could parachute back into the Reich and wreak even more havoc than they had before. As the plane approached for the drop, the agents were given a hot drink with plenty of rum. The dispatcher would open a hole in the floor of the fuselage and hitch the static line of the agent's parachutes onto a hook in the plane. When the red light came on, the agent would sit over the edge of the hole, waiting for the red light to turn green as the engines would cut to slow the plane down. One remembered, you go out straight and are just free falling until the static line opened, you're shoot for you. And after the parachute opened, agents reported they had a feeling of euphoria. All right, it's time to move on to part 2B, the American Office of Strategic Services. In July 1940, President Roosevelt sent Colonel William Donovan to London to decide if that nation had the ability to fight on after the German victories in Western Europe. Donovan, a Medal of Honor holder from World War I, met with Britain's leadership. He toured her defenses and was given access to her clandestine services. He met with the newly created Special Operations Executive, the SOE, and Colonel Menzies, the chief of Britain's Secret Intelligence Service, sometimes referred to as SIS, but also known as MI6. Donovan returned and recommended increased American aid to Britain. He wanted to create a centralized U.S. intelligence service to combat enemy espionage and subversion that was thought to be a major factor in the fall of France. Donovan wanted the U.S. service to have the advantage of combining the functions of MI6 and SOE into a single American organization. On 11 July 1941, Roosevelt ordered the creation of the Coordinator of Information, COI, as a civilian agency, with Donovan as its director. Its mission was to gather and analyze security information obtained from agents around the world and from government departments and agencies. COI was to report its findings to President Roosevelt and to government agencies that he deemed appropriate. You see the layout here for their quarters. It was established a little west of Washington's Lincoln Memorial at the intersection of 25th and East Streets, Northwest Washington. On 13 June 1942, the COI became the Office of Strategic Services under Roosevelt's Executive Order 9182. On 20 September 1945, Truman's Executive Order 9621 ended OSS operations. Roosevelt's 13 June 1942, Executive Order 9182, endorsed Donovan's unusual merger of strategic intelligence operations with paramilitary operations. Unfortunately, the order transferred the jurisdiction over the OSS from the president to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Donovan would have to wait for several months after proving the worth of the OSS for direct support to military operations and national strategy to obtain enough independence to use the full range of the OSS's many capabilities at his discretion. Finally, a JCS directive on 27 October 1943 gave OSS full authority to operate in the European Theater of Operations, the ETO, and the freedom of U.S. long-range espionage was secured. Rather than engage in unhelpful competition, the British yielded. OSS Special Operations, SO, and Counterintelligence, X2, greatly strengthened the ETO, and so the OSS was given access to the extensive files which Britain had taken decades to develop. Despite its uncertain future in early 1942, Donovan's reputation enabled OSS to recruit many professional leaders of the highest character and ability. They were already, or would be later, nationally famous in academic, diplomatic, banking, business, and other fields. Donovan brought on board several professionals in the publishing industry. Rather than train them as agents for missions in the battlefields of World War II, these writers, editors, and reporters, like Richard Helms, were most often used in Donovan's staff. Richard Helms was born on 30 March 1913 in St. David's, Pennsylvania. After attending Williams College, he began his career as a foreign correspondent in Berlin. In 1936, Helms, who was fluent in German, stood in for a United Press colleague for a luncheon interview with Adolf Hitler. Helms had worked for the Indianapolis Times for 5 years when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor in December 1941. In January 1942, Helms volunteered for the Naval Reserve. He was assigned to the Eastern Sea Frontier Headquarters in New York City. In 1943, his old boss in the Berlin UP Bureau, Frederick Ochsner, now in the OSS, asked Helms to work with him in the black propaganda section of the OSS. However, when Helms joined the OSS in Washington, he was initially assigned to the planning staff and then transferred to the German desk at OSS headquarters in London. When World War II ended, Helms was assigned to Dulles' office in Berlin. This is a rather busy chart. It's from 2 pages in a book on the OSS. I managed to put it to 1 page. And this is something you'd want to study at your own leisure if you're interested in the entire organizational chart of the OSS as it was put together in June 1942. So the fulcrum of Allied European insurgency operations behind the line stuff during World War II was counterintelligence and especially counterespionage operations. The British Bletchley Park breakthrough in a SIGINT, that signals intelligence operation codenamed ULTRA, the decryption of German code ciphers, was undeniably an Allied force multiplier on the battlefields of North Africa and Europe. Counterespionage is a major subset of counterintelligence. It refers to operations against foreign spies. An American delegation visiting Britain's Bletchley Park in mid-1943 was given a full briefing on the advances of British intelligence had made since May 1940. That was when Hut 6, the section that covered Germany's Army and Air Force, achieved the first breakthroughs in the German Enigma cipher. By 15 July 1940, the United States and the United Kingdom were ready to sign a formal exchange agreement, the BRUSA, BRUSA, Britain-USA Accord, linking their signals intelligence services. They agreed to completely exchange all information on the military and air forces of the Axis powers. McGeorge Bundy, who would later be JFK's NSC advisor, in his book, Dimensions of Diplomacy, wrote, "It is a curious fact of academic history that the first great center of area studies in the United States was not located in any university, but in Washington during World War II in the OSS. Cloak and dagger exploits of agents infiltrated behind the lines captured the public imagination. But the simple grubbing of OSS scientists provided far and away the greater contribution to America's wartime intelligence. A half hour spent with the brakeman of a freight train running into occupied France would produce more useful information than a Mata Hari could learn in a year." In October 1941, 2 months before America entered the war, Donovan had presented President Roosevelt a plan for the African operations to the coordinator of information that he thought, or he wanted to show, would become a concrete illustration of what the OSS could do. Ever since 1940, Donovan had argued that the Mediterranean was a potential battlefield. As Germany held most of the northern front in Europe, Allied control of the southern front on the African coast was vital. Operation Torch, the code name for the Allied landings in French North Africa, was the first major U.S. offensive of the war and the first OSS operation in direct support of a military action, and the crucial test of Donovan's OSS still struggling to operate without a JCS directive. "Our whole future," he told his staff, "may depend on the accuracy of our intelligence and the outcome of Torch." The Allies used the North African invasion first to gain experience. They knew they would not be able to breach Hitler's Atlantic Wall in Normandy for May of 1944. The plan in Torch called for a full-scale assault on North Africa in November 1942. Operation Torch was placed under the command of General Eisenhower. So in November 42, Lemitz, who was Ike's assistant chief of staff for operations as Torch began. For secrecy, the six B-17s transporting the command elements, including Eisenhower, had no fighter escorts. When they were attacked by German fighters, Lemitzer, who was an expert gunner familiar with the 50 caliber gun on board, he single-handedly saved Eisenhower's B-17. The Western Task Force of Torch, aimed at Casablanca, was composed of American units with Major General George S. Patton in command. Anxious to secure cooperation with the French, Ike sent Generals Lemitzer and Clark to meet covertly with a French representative not far from Algiers. The OSS successfully fooled the Germans that the landing would be in the westernmost part of Africa at Dakar. And here you can see a really nice graphic. It is a good idea to take a look at this more closely. You can see the Patton's task force coming in from the left, the Western task force there. Anyway, on the 8th of November, 170,000 Allied troops put ashore along 2,000 miles of North Africa without major opposition, while the German U-boats waited vainly in the southern Atlantic. Good job by the OSS for fooling them. On 23 December 1942, the OSS was finally given more independence from the JCS that Donovan had been seeking for 6 months. On 13 May 1943, Operation Torch ended with the Axis surrender in Tunisia, opening the way for the Allied invasion of Sicily in July. In Italy, the commander of the 5th Army, General Clark, found that his G2, or intelligence unit, had no personnel for tactical military intelligence. As a result, OSS agents with training for deep penetration to acquire strategic intelligence were used to find out the German troop strength directly behind General Clark's front lines. OSS secret intelligence, SI, included the location, movement, and patterns of activity of enemy units, the strength and capabilities of resistance movements, and the location of infrastructure and industrial targets, and the gathering of economic, political, social, and psychological intelligence, the German secret weapons program, and atomic research. The OSS Special Operations, SO, branch was created to take the war directly to the enemy through unorthodox warfare, the direct sabotage of enemy targets, and training local resistance forces in guerrilla warfare. Small SO teams, or circuits, as they're sometimes called, sabotage targets of strategic importance, such as factories or railway tunnels, or targets of a tactical nature like bridges and supply dumps. SO teams organized, supplied, and trained local resistance groups with allied weaponry to conduct a sustained insurgency campaign of sabotage and ambush. Since many of these activities were in direct support of allied operations, SO units came under the authority of their respective allied military theater commanders. Several sections of SO, such as the operations groups, maritime units, and technical development, later became separate OSS branches in their own right. OSS Morale Operations, MO, this branch was established in January 1943 to cause disharmony and chaos among enemy troops and civilians by use of black propaganda, lies, and deception spread by radio broadcasts and printed materials to subvert enemy morale. A key distinction between Office of War Information and MO propaganda was its perceived origins. OWI material was overtly advertised as coming directly from the Allies, but MO material was crafted to give the impression that it came from resistance movements or from the enemy itself. Although the direct impact of such methods is difficult to precisely quantify, countermeasures such as denials in official publications and the jamming of radio broadcasts proved that MO activities did not go unnoticed. Several instances were noted of rumors and lies that MO had spread behind enemy lines, turning up later, now other reports are on or in the press. OSS counterespionage is X2, before X2's creation in June 1943, Secret Intelligence, SI, handled all X2 matters. In response to OSS requests for access to ultra decrypts, the British agreed on the condition that the OSS establish its own self-contained counterintelligence branch, which would be given exclusive access to Ultra and their counterespionage files. X2 counterespionage used its special status to check the backgrounds of potential OSS agents, reject proposed OSS operations on security grounds, protect OSS activities overseas from enemy penetration, operate directly enemy operatives in neutral nations, and capture and turn enemy stay-behind agents in France and Italy. The operational headquarters of X2 was established in London due to its close proximity to the Bletchley Park facility and the other Allied counterespionage services. While X2 in London directed operations in Europe and the Mediterranean, X2 in Washington directed counterespionage operations in the Far East. Born on 9 December 1917, James Jesus Angleton spent his boyhood in Milan, Italy, after his father, Hugh, moved his family there. He went to Malvern College, a boarding school in England, before going to Yale University in 1939. In Italy, during the summer of 1948, Angleton's close relationship with poet Ezra Pound piqued his interest in espionage. In 1943, Angleton was drafted into the U.S. Army. At OSS headquarters in London, his official, his OSS friend Norman Pearson got Angleton assigned to his X2 counterintelligence branch as chief of the Italy desk. By February 1944, Angleton was transferred to Italy to take command of Secret Unit Z counterintelligence, one that handled decrypted ultra intercepts from German communications in Britain. In October 1944, Angleton's superiors in the OSS London headquarters X2 counter-espionage operations wanted his 17-man X2 Rome unit quickly expanded. In the last year of the war, Angleton's talents as a field operative in his mid-20s led to his rise from chief of the X2 unit in Rome to chief of all OSS counter-espionage in Italy. This is the guy who's going to become head of counterintelligence in the CIA years later. Donovan believed that academia could play an important intelligence role by using data and analysis to identify enemy weak points,
The research and analysis branch, R&A branch, was divided into primary geographic divisions of Europe, Africa, Far East, USSR, and Latin America, and each subdivided into economic, political, and specific geographic sections. R&A employed prominent historians, economists, sociologists, diplomats, and other experts for their intellectual, analytical, and research abilities. Materials from the Library of Congress, university libraries, research institutions, government agencies, and from OSS agents in the field were used by R&A to produce reports either on demand or on its own initiative. R&A reports were sent to other OSS branches, government agencies, and the military. In the summer of 1942, R&A learned of Allied plans to invade North Africa. The entire staff worked day and night for weeks to produce several detailed reports on Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia, much to the astonished satisfaction of the military. R&A also produced soldiers' guides for U.S. troops stationed overseas. R&A created a map division. The map division produced unique maps showing the economic, political, and military situation of a specific country or area. Information on these specially prepared maps included transportation routes, communications, industry, national resources, terrain, and weather. The next OSS operation after Operation Torch came in December 1942 when an SI team landed in southern Corsica from the French submarine Casablanca. They radioed reports on enemy occupation forces until their capture in May 1943. After the Italian armistice in September 1943, the French resistance, or Maquis, on Corsica rose up. They hastily assembled a free French force along with a small SI Directeur General, DG, team assisted in the island's liberation. SI organized the Maquis in gathering current intelligence, while the DG team assisted French troops in harassing the withdrawing Germans until they completely abandoned Corsica in October 1943. In June 1943, an SI team was landed in northwestern Sardinia by a PT boat, but they were quickly captured by the Italians. After the Italian armistice, a small operational group team parachuted into southern Sardinia and made arrangements with the Italians for the arrival of U.S. occupation forces. Now, the OSS was forbidden from infiltrating teams into Sicily before the Allied invasion in July 1943 in order not to alert the Germans. The small OSS team that followed the troops ashore were inexperienced in gathering tactical information. Locally recruited line crossers accomplished very little, and one ill-conceived operation behind Axis lines resulted in the capture of the head of that SO unit. Secret intelligence. So in February 1943, saw the first OSS agent, independent of any particular branch, infiltrated into France from the French submarine Casablanca to set up a clandestine radio station in the southern port of Toulon. Other radio stations followed. And while they eventually fell under the jurisdiction of SI Special Intelligence, the first official penetration into France by that branch came in August 1943, when the Penny Farthing team parachuted in and set up a base in Lyon. As more SI teams landed in southern France, chains of sub-agents were formed, their information being either radioed to OSS headquarters in Algiers or sent by courier across the Pyrenees to OSS stations in Spain. Intelligence gathered by these networks played a key role in the successful Allied landings on the Riviera coast in August 1944. The first Special Operations SO agents to land in France in June 1943 were instructors and radio operators to provide assistance to British SOE, so-called S-circuits, already in place. Each S-circuit normally had an organizer, his lieutenant, and a radio operator, as well as recruited, trained, and equipped resistance fighters in its region. SO personnel operated in many SOF circuits. They also established several of their own, beginning with the Virginia Hall, also known as Sacristan, in June 1943. She had previously worked undercover in Vichy France for the SOE. She organized the only SO circuit to be led by a woman. Hall armed over 400 Maquis,
who conducted ambushes, derailed several trains in their tunnels, and demolished several railroad bridges in the summer of 1944. All right, and finally, in this last part of the section, section 2C, we're going to turn to a fairly short but very interesting and very important operation, Operation Jedburgh. It was a joint effort between the special operations of the OSS and the British Special Operations Executive and the Free French. They established three-man teams that could quickly organize, supply, train and accompany resistance groups in direct support of advancing Allied armies. In contrast to the regionally rooted F circuits, Jedburghs could be dropped anywhere in France, contingent on the battlefield situation. To avoid alerting the Germans, General Eisenhower forbade the first Jedburgh team from deploying to France until the night of the Normandy invasion, but soon afterwards, teams began parachuting across France. The Jedburghs were also successful in keeping resistance groups of different political loyalties focused on fighting the Germans instead of each other. In August 1944, additional Jedburgh teams were parachuted in to protect General Patton's flanks as his troops simultaneously advanced on the port city of Brest and towards the German border. The teams organized local resistance groups to block and harass German units. Many Jedburgh teams were unable to fulfill their missions because they were overrun by the faster-than-expected American advance. In September 1944, Jedburgh teams were attached to the airborne divisions in Operation Market Garden in Holland. Their goal was to create the local Dutch to recruit the local Dutch resistance to provide assistance and intelligence, as well as establishing a communication link between the airborne forces and the special forces headquarters in London. The Jedburghs landed along with the paratroopers, which often did not allow them much time. Many of their radios were lost or damaged. Some teams were unable to fulfill their missions due to nonstop German attacks along the airborne perimeters. The Jedburghs near Nijmegen in Netherlands were more successful. The tri-national Jedburgh team Dudley was deployed separately in eastern Holland. It conducted intelligence and sabotage operations. However, by the end of 1944, its effectiveness had suffered from disunity among Dutch resistance groups and from German countermeasures. As the Normandy invasion neared, the three-man Jedburgh teams were forming up for the mission. In December 1943, Bill Colby, later to be a DCI, CIA chief, he sailed for London to be trained by British commandos and the Special Operations Executive in the Dark Arts. Besides a radio agent, any nationality, ideally the teams had either a British SOE or American OSS officer like William Colby, and either a French, Belgian, or Dutch officer. On 12 August, after the St. Lo breakout of Patton's Third Army, the Jedburghs were summoned to London. Colby jumped with two free Frenchmen from 1,500 feet into the heart of German-occupied France. They landed at the wrong place, a well-built-up urban area, and had to abandon all 10 of their supply chutes to get out of there quickly. Behind German lines, they arranged for a dozen drops of rifles, carbines, mortars, bazookas, and machine guns. Thus armed, the Maquis resistance fighters in the region tripled as the war was now going against the Germans. The uprising was on. Patton's Third Army was moving so fast toward Germany that his right flank was open, which the Jedburghs and Maquis successfully protected. Colby's team Bruce went to Paris for a gathering of the surviving Jedburghs. When he returned to London, he was assigned to take command of the OSS Norwegian Special Operations, NORSO group. In Norway, after successfully leading his group in Operation Wright, blowing up bridges carrying German troops, Colby was assigned to East Asia. That assignment never happened. While Colby was on leave in New York, the U.S. dropped atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, bringing the war in the Pacific to an end on 2 September 1945.
Okay. This question comes from Heather Fear. It says, why would Burris want to make it appear that LBJ ordered him to join the Army Air Forces instead of his congressman?
Yes, it's a good question, and it's complicated. But anyway, Birkenall actually was Burris's true supervisor during the Kennedy presidency. Now, Burris pretended that Vice President Johnson was his boss at the time. For the sake of continuity, Burris had to change his past, too, which is why he made up that story about LBJ pulling him off the oil rig, which wasn't true. But the fact was that Burris's real job in the Kennedy years was to prepare his understudy, LBJ, to become president. So you have LBJ as, the case officer is Burris. LBJ is the understudy. And all this business about going back to the oil rigs in World War II was superimposed later on in order to make this idea during the Kennedy administration that LBJ was the boss of Burris when the opposite was true. Imagine that, a colonel being the boss of the vice president. Anyway, that's the answer for that one.
Okay. Well, our next question comes from Alan Dale. And it says, what role did Limitzer's saving General Eisenhower's life in North Africa play in the relationship?
Immediately, I began turning to Limitzer to take on all kinds of sensitive missions. I alluded to one, but it was a harrowing covert nighttime landing from a submarine and having to paddle ashore, not knowing whether they were going to live or die. They had to contact the French in order to make a deal so that the French in North Africa would support the Americans, and it worked. And other sensitive missions like that. But later on, Lemitzer was so dear to Eisenhower's heart that when General Taylor began to move in a direction contradicting the nuclear doctrine, which was taking place in the Eisenhower administration, General Taylor had to leave, and so Eisenhower had moved Lemitzer in to be the deputy chief of staff of the Army. So all of a sudden now he becomes the chief of staff of the Army. So when we come out of all that later on, he's going to be the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Taylor's going to be looking for a way to get back in the game. So it was the relationship going back to that time when I had his life saved by Lemitzer that started that, cascade of events that where he ended up landing at the top of the heap. All these things fit together over a very long time.
Okay. Our next question comes from Greg Malkoff, and it says, do you think Operation Gladio played the primary operational role rather than anti-Castro Cubans and the mafia who were perhaps used more as false cover?
Yeah. Okay, so we haven't got to Gladio yet. That's coming up. But Gladio took place over about five decades in Europe. And I'm going to talk about it. We got a whole section and with some very exciting work that Heather Fear did. So I think I would like to withhold talking about that till after everyone who's watching or listening has had a chance to hear what we've got to show you on Gladio.
Okay, and then you can comment on that after we show the next piece there.
Yeah.
Let's see here. Okay, I don't have any more questions in the chat log at the moment. Would anybody like to submit a question for Dr. Newman about the presentations that we just saw? If so, please type them in the chat now.
I think it's okay to move on because we're really just setting the stage. I told you that there would be quite a bit of stuff on World War II, and we're now getting to the point after this intermission here, moving past World War II into the rest of the 40s, which includes just the start of Gladio and other things like what happens to the Organization of American Intelligence. So I would vote we move on. All right, now it's time to turn to Section 3. This section deals with the Nazis and American traitors aiding Hitler's war machine as American soldiers were dying on the battlefields of World War II. Recall what we started with at the very beginning about Alan Dulles and Heinrich Himmler and von Schroeder about we were fighting the wrong enemy. We'll go back over some of that to get started here in Section 3. In November 1942, Dulles became chief of the Office of Strategic Services Station in Bern, Switzerland. And there, 18 months before the Allied invasion of Normandy, Dulles made that extraordinary claim to the OSS, to OSS Chief William Donovan about fighting the wrong enemy. Heinrich Himmler, head of Hitler's SS domestic paramilitary security entity, and Walter Schellenberg, head of Hitler's SS Foreign Intelligence Unit, were seeking a separate peace between the Nazi government and the U.S. so that the Third Reich could focus on fighting the Soviet Union. In his communiques with Donovan, Dulles endorsed the Nazi proposal on the grounds that a strong post-war Germany was essential to help counter the communist threat from the Soviet Union. The Dulles brothers, John Foster and Allen, were making heaps of money from feeding Hitler's war machine. They were partners in Sullivan and Cromwell. That firm, along with Brown Brothers Harriman, were the two most powerful Wall Street firms aiding the Nazis. For President Roosevelt, this constituted treason. The Nazi support from Avril Harriman and Prescott Bush was inextricably intertwined with Nazi banker Kurt von Schroeder. He was a close associate of the Dulles brothers. Bush's shipping line subsidized Nazi propaganda in America and smuggled Nazi spies into the U.S. even after America had entered the war. In 1944, Schroeder was the outlet for ITT money, talked about this before, that was funneled to Himmler, while the U.S. soldiers were dying in the war with Germany. Bush hired Alan Dulles to hide his Nazi assets. Standard Oil was another Dulles client that hired him to cloak its activities. Alan Dulles found out at some point that Naval Officer Richard Nixon had been put in charge of captured enemy documents revealing that Dulles was a traitor. Dulles financed Nixon's first race for office in exchange for burying those documents showing that Dulles was a traitor. So the Kepler Circle originated as a group of German businessmen supporting Hitler's rise to power before and during 1933. In the mid-1930s, the Kepler Circle came under the influence and protection of SS Chief Himmler and the organizational control of banker and prominent Nazi businessman Kurt von Schroeder. Within this innermost circle, which was the very core of Nazism, we find Wall Street, Standard Oil of New Jersey, and ITT represented from 33 all the way to 19 through 1944. Wilhelm Kepler, founder of the original Circle of Friends, typifies the well-known phenomenon of a politicized businessman. The Kepler Circle began in 1931 and included Hitler, Kepler, and many others. In 33, Kepler was elected to the Reichstag and became one of Hitler's financial experts. Kepler was the chairman of the very firm that utilized U.S. technology for the vital synthetic fuel that enabled the Wehrmacht to go to war in 1939. Profits and control of these fundamentally important technologies, U.S. technologies for German military ends, were retained by a small group of international firms and businessmen operating across national borders. Major U.S. multinationals were also very well represented in the later Heinrich Himmler Circle and made cash contributions to the SS up to 1944 while World War II was in progress. It was the Stein Bank that held the secrets of the associations of American subsidiaries with Nazi authorities while World War II was in progress. In 1943 and 44, Standard Oil of New Jersey made a large contribution to Himmler's special account through its wholly owned 94% worth German subsidiary, the German-American Gesellschaft. A Treasury Department analysis reported that until mid-1942, these things happened around the Ford Corporation. One, the business of the Ford subsidiaries in France substantially increased. Two, their production was solely for the benefit of the Germans and the countries under its occupation. Third, the Germans have shown clearly their wish to protect the Ford interests because of the attitude of strict neutrality maintained by Henry Ford and the late Edsel Ford. And lastly, the increased activity of the French Ford subsidiaries on behalf of the Germans received the commendation of the Ford family in America. These disloyal events occurred amid the deception going on during Roosevelt's administration. Surrounded by prominent Americans involved in supplying Germany's war machine, the president walked a fine line between reining them in and sometimes looking the other way. These events occurred during the insertion of stay-behind units we talked about in Section 2 of the British Special Operations Executive and the American Office of Strategic Services. SOE operations in Europe got off to an early start 2 years ahead of OSS insertions due to the lingering legacy of isolation. We talked about this in the previous section. The Dulles brothers, John Foster and Allen, were associated with the Council on Foreign Relations, a group of wealthy industrialists and bankers whose goal was to, quote, make the world safe for democracy. As director of Central Intelligence, Alan Dulles would later assist the undertakings of Operation Gladio. We'll see that in the next section, Section 4. In 1944, from Alan Dulles' point of view, Germany was yesterday's enemy. Now the real threat to Anglo-American power was the communist USSR. Dulles advised OSS Chief Donovan to make plans to assist secret German stay-behind armies and supply them with weapons. Dulles proposed that the head of the German intelligence, Reinhard Gehlen, and Himmler's chief of staff, General Karl Wolff, organize these Gladio army units in Germany. As World War II approached, the Rockefellers' links to the Nazi regime were strengthened by a partnership with the J.H. Schroeder Bank of New York, forming Schroeder, Rockefeller & Company in 1936. At the time of Pearl Harbor, the Rockefellers Chase National Bank was the most powerful U.S. financial institution. They owned Standard Oil of New Jersey, whose German accounts were siphoned through their own bank, the Chase. The Chase Bank in Paris was the focus of substantial financing of the Nazi embassy's activities throughout World War II with the full knowledge of New York. While American soldiers were dying on the battlefields of Europe, Dulles secretly worked to create a separate peace with Nazi generals Himmler, Gehlen, and Wolff. As Hitler's invasion was slowly rolled back on the Russian and European fronts, British Field Marshal Alexander, Supreme Allied Commander Mediterranean Operations, arranged for his protege, U.S. General Lenitzer, to negotiate the Nazi surrender of their forces in Italy. Dulles conducted meetings with Gehlen and Bern in Dulles' office. Knowing the defeat of the Third Reich was certain, Gehlen's idea was to form clandestine guerrilla squads composed of Hitler youth and diehard fascist fanatics as stay-behind units. He referred to this as his secret army of werewolves, individuals who would be normal citizens by day and communist killers by night. Gehlen's werewolves would become known as gladiators, whose ostensible purpose was to be used behind the lines of the invading Soviet army. This would become known as Operation Gladio, for the short swords used by Roman gladiators. Section 4 will deal more with Operation Gladio. Bush and Harriman hit their Nazi activities even while Harriman served as FDR's emissary to Britain for Lend-Lease. The treachery of Allen Dulles, the Rockefellers, and Prescott Bush can be gauged by the vast pipeline used to launder Nazi assets. Brown Brothers Harriman was the conduit to invest money into Nazi Germany. Union Bank was the return pipe for the profits. Moreover, FDR's seizure of Union Bank, a primary source of funding for Prescott Bush, was never announced or widely published at the time. Some suspected the hush-up was due to the Roosevelt-Harriman connection. FDR believed widespread exposure of U.S. traitors would cause a public scandal, hurt public morale, cause strikes, and provoke military mutinies. He was planning to deal with traitors such as Bush and Harriman after the war, but his secret died with him just before the end of the war. Behind the battlefronts of World War II, through intermediaries in Switzerland and North Africa, the New York financial elite collaborated with the Nazi regime. Captured files after the war yielded a massive evidence demonstrating that for some elements of big business, the period 1941-45 was business as usual. An official report to Secretary of the Treasury, Secretary Morgenthau, concluded that the situations of Ford and Chase Bank convince us that it is imperative to investigate immediately on the spot the activities of subsidiaries of at least some of the larger American firms which were operating in France during German occupation. The two Wall Street firms that aided the Nazis the most were, as we've said, Sullivan and Cromwell and Brown Brothers Harriman. Sullivan and Cromwell was the Wall Street law firm that employed the Dulles brothers and the son of Samuel Bush, Prescott Bush. Captured German documents revealed that a post-war Nazi sabotage plot in the U.S. was working to cover up their crimes and assets. At the center of this denazification plot were Wall Street law firms Sullivan and Cromwell and Brown Brothers Harriman. But at the very eye of this corrupt plot were Prescott Bush, John Foster Dulles, and Allen Dulles. Bush and Allen Dulles cooperated to hide the Nazi crimes and assets. Finally, congressional investigators after the war showed that the United Steel had supplied huge amounts of the pig iron and other important ferrous metal products needed by Hitler's war machine. By 1945, the Treasury Department revealed to Congress the United Steel produced the following percentages of war munitions for the Nazis. Pig iron, 50.8%. Pipe and tubes, 45.5%. Universal plate, 41.4%. Galvanized sheet, 38.5%. Heavy plate, 36%. Explosives, 35%. Prescott Bush was Hitler's banker for United Steel. All these materials could outfit all the big artillery pieces, tanks, and everything else that Hitler's war machine needed to get World War II started and to continue. I now turn to Section 4. This section deals with Operation Gladio. Gladio was clandestine operations by the CIA and Britain's MI6, hidden in super-secret so-called NATO committees. When the anticipated Soviet invasion of Europe failed to materialize, Gladio's purpose and strategy quickly changed. Gladio used a strategy of tension, false flag operations, including assassination, sabotage, and intimidation. Gladio sought to interfere in the domestic politics of European nations to destroy or neutralize socialist and communist political parties. Up to the present day, neither the United States nor the United Kingdom, i.e. the CIA and MI6, have ever openly admitted their connections with Gladio, let alone the details of how they funded the secret armies using sabotage and assassination to interfere in the domestic politics of European states. However, many participants have spoken up. After his retirement, Tom Polgar, the CIA station chief from 1949 to the mid-50s in Frankfurt, Germany, spoke openly about the scandal. Polgar recalled, quote, "With the emergence of NATO in Western Europe, directives were issued to establish European-wide stay-behind organizations along the lines which existed in the final years of World War II in Western Europe." Polgar said the secret Gladio units were coordinated by a, quote, "unconventional warfare planning group linked to NATO." And that's a reference to NATO's Allied Clandestine Committee, the ACC, and the Clandestine Planning Committee, the CPC. Polgar stated, quote, "It's been claimed that the CIA created Gladio, but that's impossible. The CIA was created in September 1947. Gladio existed in Italy, Switzerland, France, Belgium, and probably Spain before that, and the Americans jumped on the bandwagon." André Moyen of Belgian military intelligence was involved in Gladio. As he explained, quote, "In September 1945, I was called back by my boss and sent to the Belgian Minister of the Interior. He said to me, 'I need you. Go and see my Italian colleague, Mario Selva.' I went to Rome and Mario Selva told me, 'We have a stay-behind network, Gladio.' He showed how his forces could be active within 6 minutes. The Italian problem was different because their principal enemy was not the Soviet army, but the threat posed by Italian communism. They got 40% in the elections. This was Selva's worry. That's why he had these Gladio task forces." The chief of Italy's political police, Federico D'Amato, recall, quote, "I was working at the hotel where General Meltzer was based. He was the head of the German armed forces in Rome. When they left, others remained in place, something like Operation Gladio. When the Americans came, they were already in custody." D'Amato said, quote, "Since my father was a police official and knew everyone, the counterintelligence X2 branch of the OSS decided to parachute me, a complete novice, into the region of Repubblica di Salo, where I met many officials. They naturally agreed to cooperate. After the war, they became important leaders of the Italian state and the police forces and the Ministry of the Interior." According to U.S. Army Colonel De La Winter of CIA ITAC, ITAC is Intelligence Threat and Analysis Center, quote, "Gladio was a joint brainchild, but its most intense architect was Angleton. As most people know, he was a sort of a professional paranoiac." De Winter recalled, quote, "In 1943 to 1945, an OSS officer in Rome by the name of Peter Tompkins was sent into Italy to contact the heads of the joint partisan groups. Then Jim Angleton appeared, recruiting fascists, because he figured that the best way to control the communists was to hire fascists. One of the toughest was Prince Valerio Borghese. His guys would execute partisans and hang them from lampposts all over Italy. Angleton made a deal with Borghese. Then he rushed up to save this commander from the partisans who would have lynched him anytime." Gladio's strategy included false flag operations, bombing buildings, assassinating center-right people, and then blaming it on the communists and socialists. A very notorious false flag operation by Hitler was the 1933 Reichstag fire in Berlin. Hitler, who had become prime minister just 1 month before the fire, immediately publicly blamed the crime on the German Communist Party. The next morning, Hitler arrested 4,000 communists, political opponents, and critical journalists. He then abolished parliament and transferred all powers to the executive headed by himself. According to the 1990 official German report on Gladio, the setting up of stay-behind nets in European countries had already started shortly after the end of the Second World War. After the defeat of Germany in 1945, the chaotic post-war conditions were ideal for the U.S. to set up a stay-behind network. As an occupying power, the U.S. controlled territory together with the French, British, and Soviet forces in their respective zones. There was an abundant supply of anti-communist Nazis trained in guerrilla warfare and experienced with arms and explosives who had hunted communists for Hitler's dreaded SS. The U.S. secretly recruited them for the German stay-behind network. The Pentagon used the new U.S. Counterintelligence Corps, CIC, to track down German Nazis facing charges at the Nuremberg trials. The CIC secretly recruited selected right-wing extremists for use by the anti-communist army in Germany. This Pentagon activity was finally revealed in 1986 at a large press conference. The U.S. Department of Justice, DOJ, admitted that the CIC had recruited a high-ranking Nazi in the post-war years. A 600-page long study compiled by the DOJ confirmed that SS and Gestapo officer Klaus Barbie had been recruited by the CIC in 1947 and then had been hidden from war crimes investigators. The most prominent Nazi recruited by the CIC was Hitler's spy chief, General Reinhard Gehlen, who had started his Secret Service career under Hitler in April 1942. Gehlen derived much of his information from his role in the torture, interrogation, and murder by starvation of 4 million Soviet prisoners of war. On 20 May 1945, after Gehlen saw that that Germany was losing the war, he ensured that the Russians would never get him by delivering himself up to the U.S. CIC. Gehlen had microfilmed his extensive data on the USSR, packed the films in watertight steel drums, and secretly buried them in the Austrian Alps. Gehlen's data was of great interest to the U.S. military. After several weeks of internment, Gehlen was able to reveal his secret to U.S. General Edwin Luther Seiber. Seiber promoted Gehlen's career for years and introduced him to senior U.S. intelligence officials, including General Walter Bettel Smith, then the highest U.S. Army intelligence officer in Europe, who later became Director of Central Intelligence during 1950 to 1953. Seiber also introduced Gehlen to OSS Chief William Donovan, OSS Officer Alan Dulles, who also later became the DCI, and OSS Officer Frank Wisner, who later was Chief of CIA's Office of Policy Coordination, the OPC, that set up the European stay-behind network. With Gehlen's help, the U.S. dug up the microfilms in Austria. In August 1945, Seiber shipped Gehlen with his data to Washington. President Truman was impressed. He named Gehlen, together with many of Gehlen's Nazi network, chief of the first post-war German Secret Service to Organization Gehlen, ORG. Erhard Dobringhaus, who had worked with the US CIC in Germany from 1948 to 1949, recalled that he had taken part in the recruitment of Nazis. Erhard recalled, quote, "In 1948, I was a special agent for the Counterintelligence Corps in occupied Germany. I was stationed in Augsburg. Since I spoke fluent German, I was assigned to handle a network of German informants. Among them was Klaus Barbie. Later, I discovered that he was wanted for murder by the French, and I reported this to my superiors, and they told me to keep nice and quiet." Colonel Günther Bernau, was an informant working for the U.S. military intelligence in Stuttgart. According to Dobringhaus, Bernau was crucial in setting up the German state behind army. Quote, I remember him taking me to one particular spot, which we uncovered and dug it out. There were rifles, small arms, and grenades, all nicely wrapped in cosmoline grease. And Bernau said, quote, we have thousands of these all over the country. They are all working for us in case the communists come over the Iron Curtain. In 1990, a former NATO intelligence officer stated that Frank Wisner's CIA covert action branch set up the German secret army to incorporate the espionage unit run by Hitler's spy chief Reinhard Gehlen, lock, stock, and barrel, into the CIA. So in August 1945, Alan Dulles transported General Gehlen and his top representatives to Fort Hunt, Virginia, in a DC-3 belonging to General Bettel Smith, then the commander of U.S. Forces European Theater. In Fort Hunt Park, Virginia, the Germans were wined and dined during high-level talks with U.S. military and intelligence officials. They agreed Gehlen would return to Germany under U.S. protection to establish the organization Gehlen, ORG. ORG would receive full funding from U.S. Army G2 intelligence resources. The agreement further stipulated, quote, the primary purpose of this organization would be the maintenance of the existing stay-behind armies and their recruitment of new guerrilla soldiers from the ranks of Third Reich veterans with staunch anti-communist credentials. These soldiers would no longer be known as werewolves. They were to be known as gladiators and commissioned to ward off communist invaders in the great theater of post-war Europe. During World War II, Britain and the United States had placed stay-behind nets behind German lines. And after the defeat of Germany in 1945, the post-war chaos was ideal for the United States and Britain to train and finance stay-behind nets in Europe. In 1945, the Gehlen organization in Germany was to be known as Gladio, after the short swords Roman gladiators used to kill their opponents. In 1948, the Office of Policy Coordination in the CIA inherited this mission. On 25 August 1948, Great Britain, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg entered into the Brussels Pact, motivated by growing fear that Moscow was bent on the conquest of the continent. Defense Secretary James Forrestal sent Major General Lyman Lemnitzer, the future chairman of the JCS, to London as his personal spy during the five power meetings. European countries agreed to the placement of networks of secret operatives in their own territories. The secret nets were organized into small-scale or large-scale resistance movements to operate behind Soviet lines. In some cases, stay-behind Gladio nets planned to allow themselves to be overrun by enemy forces in order to conduct intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance from concealed pre-positioned hideouts. As Allied plans for war with the Soviet bloc expanded, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization was founded in April 1949. With headquarters in Brussels, its 29 member states agreed to mutual defense in response to any external attack. From the time of NATO's creation, the director of its Office of Security handled the covert activities of Operation Gladio, including operations related to espionage, terrorism, subversion, and communist threats in Europe. U.S. Army Colonel LeWinter recalled, quote, superimposed over NATO, there was a coordinating office in something called ITAC, I think that's Intelligence Threat and Analysis Center, which was nominally in the Defense Department. Although that NATO desk was nominally with the Defense Intelligence Agency, it was owned and staffed by the CIA. To coordinate the secret Gladio plans and activities with the military leadership of NATO, in 1952, the intelligence services taking part in the operation established the so-called Clandestine Planning Committee, CPC. In order to coordinate cooperation among themselves, in 1954, they established the so-called Allied Clandestine Committee, the ACC. The German government furthermore confirmed that the BND had been a regular member of both CPC and ACC ever since 1959. All right, summarizing now. During the Cold War, Gladio became NATO's clandestine operational arm and employed a strategy of tension, assassinations, social violence, and prefabricated false flag chaos to disrupt the political aspirations of socialists and communists. Staffed by right-wing terror groups, former Nazis, and Mussolini fascists, these terrorist paramilitary units were very active when JFK unknowingly gave Lemnitzer control over them by appointing him as the Supreme Allied Commander Europe in October 1962. At the SAC Europe in 1962, Lemnitzer was well informed about the secret Gladio armies. After all, he had supplied the weapons to them in the late 1940s. The SAC Europe was always a U.S. officer, supervised the secret armies through NATO's Clandestine Planning Committee, CPC, and the Allied Clandestine Committee, the ACC. And finally, in 1959 in Italy, the Gladio Stay Behind units evolved into covert Masonic lodges that popped up on NATO bases all over Italy and became mafia magnates that contacted American Masons who funded the fight against the Red Menace. General Lemnitzer was an active 33-degree Mason at that time. There will be a lot more about that in Volume 4 when it's published. In 1963, CIA Rome Station Chief William Harvey endorsed a strategy of tension in Italy, political, psychological, and paramilitary, to diminish the power of the Italian Communist Party by intimidation and false flag operations. I return now to Section 5. This section deals with the evolution of U.S. intelligence after World War II. In October 1943, Prime Minister Churchill sent British Foreign Minister Anthony Eden on a secret mission to Stalin to carve up the Balkan states. In 1945, the Yalta Agreement placed Greece under the protection of the United States and the United Kingdom, while Bulgaria, Romania, were both placed under the aegis of the USSR. In May 1945, Churchill proclaimed the advent of an Iron Curtain. In May 1945, following Churchill's Iron Curtain speech, the outbreak of the Cold War was paralleled by a thoroughgoing six-year restructuring of American national security organizations. At President Roosevelt's request in the fall of 1944, OSS Chief Donovan submitted a secret memorandum to the president recommending the creation of a new permanent American intelligence service. But the Roosevelt-Donovan plan for a new U.S. intelligence service was stillborn. The plan for the new intelligence service fell victim to a distrust of secret intelligence organizations, the Cold War crisis in Europe, and American xenophobic anti-communism. Roosevelt tried to revive the plan in April 1945, but he died a week later. President Truman, decrying a peacetime Gestapo, ordered the disbanding of the OSS on 20 September 1945. He would regret that later. Assistant Secretary of War John McCloy saved two parts of the OSS and a new peacetime strategy. On 1 October 1945, Executive Order 9621 abolished the OSS and established a strategic services unit headed by General John Magruder. Truman soon realized that his decision to disband the OSS was a mistake. So in January 1946, he combined the counterintelligence assets of the SSU with a new intelligence service, the Central Intelligence Group, CIG. Truman's 1946 directive also transferred the remaining espionage and counter-espionage assets to a new Office of Special Operations, OSO, in the CIG. In September 1946, Truman's aide, Clark Clifford, wrote a report that would become Truman's hallmark programs, the Truman Doctrine, the Marshall Plan, and the North Atlantic Alliance, later NATO. On 26 July 1947, the National Security Act made executive branch changes that had been under discussion since 1945. The act created the National Security Council, the NSC, an independent Air Force, a Secretary of Defense, and a committee of the service chiefs, the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The CIG became an independent department and was renamed the Central Intelligence Agency. Meanwhile, in early 1947, the State Department Security Office merged with the Division of Security and Investigations, Security and Investigations. Robert Bannerman became the chief of the new division, along with a 50% salary cut. His deputy, Morse Allen, was sent to the New York field office as the new chief of evaluations. In November 1947, Bannerman left the State Department to join the CIA security component, the Inspection and Security Staff, ISS, as its deputy director. The ISS director, Sheffield Edwards, was a retired U.S. Army colonel. Bannerman played a key role in the evolution of the agency's security program. In February 1948, Czechoslovakia fell to a communist coup as communist strikes paralyzed Italy and France. At the same time, Greece was at war with communist guerrillas in its northern provinces, and Moscow initiated a total blockade of Berlin. In March 48, a near hysteria shocked the U.S. government due to the so-called war scare. The crisis was precipitated by a cable from General Lucius Clay, Commander-in-Chief European Command, on the likelihood of a Soviet attack on Western Europe and the United States. General Clay's cable articulated the degree of suspicion and outright fear of the Soviet Union that was shared by policymakers in 1948. On the domestic front, there was an increasing alarm over the extent of Soviet espionage being conducted in the U.S. In Europe, the U.S. and its allies anticipated the movement of Soviet military forces across Europe all the way to the Atlantic coast. American officials concluded that fighting communist aggression in Europe required covert military units akin to the wartime OSS and British special operations teams deployed during the war. At the State Department, Secretary Marshall had appointed George Kennan, the strongest advocate for this covert strategy, as his chief of policy planning. On 4 May 1948, in an atmosphere of near-war panic caused by the Soviets' launch of the Berlin blockade, Kennan's policy planning staff presented a plan for, quote, the inauguration of organized political warfare, unquote, that involved the creation of a, quote, covert political warfare operations directorate within the government. The 1948 war scares, there was more than one, obviously, energized the covert Gladio stay-behind paramilitary units in Europe, discussed earlier in Part 4. In June 1948, National Security Directive NSCID 10/2 defined these types of covert action. Quote, such operations shall include any covert activities related to propaganda, subversion against hostile forces, and support of indigenous anti-communist elements in threatened countries of the free world. If discovered, those secret covert operations had to be plausibly deniable by the U.S. government. So neither the State Department Secretary Marshall nor the Defense Secretary Forstall wanted this covert action directorate in their departments. And so Director of Central Intelligence, DCI Roscoe H. Hillencoder reluctantly agreed to provide quarters, funding, and staff within the CIA, while the Pentagon and Kennan's policy planning staff, PPS, would provide policy guidance, bypassing the DCI. Kennan selected OSS veteran Frank Wisner to run this covert CIA directorate. In June 1948, a new clandestine CIA component was established for the execution of covert operations, including psychological warfare, political warfare, economic warfare, and paramilitary activities. On 1 September 1948, this component was soon renamed the Office of Policy Coordination. On 25 August 1948, Great Britain, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg began organizing for a coming war with the Soviet Union. As I mentioned previously, they agreed to the Brussels Pact, motivated by the growing fear that Moscow was bent on the conquest of Europe. Although not a party to the pact, Defense Secretary James Forrestal sent General Lemnitzer to London as his personal spy during the five power meetings. Allied preparations for conflict with the Soviet bloc quickly expanded. In April 1949, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, was founded. Headquartered in Brussels, its eventual 29 member states agreed to mutual defense in response to any external attack. Frank Wisner headed the OPC, Office of Policy Coordination, from 1948 to 1950. As the OPC grew quickly, the need for covert support swelled. In October 1950, Walter Badel Smith replaced Hillenkoetter as the director of the Central Intelligence, DCI. Smith seized control of the CIA's OPC so that henceforth the state and defense departments could only task the OPC through the DCI. On 1 August 1951, Smith brought the agency's two espionage and counter-espionage arms, the CIA's OPC and the Office of Special Operations, OSO, together in the clandestine services, CS, of the CIA under Alan Dulles. Soon afterwards, the clandestine services was renamed the Directorate of Plans, DP, with Alan Dulles still in charge as the CIA Deputy Director of Plans. When Dulles was promoted to the DCI in 1952, Frank Wisner became the new DDP. During this period of intense national security reorganization, there was an urgent need for interrogations of potentially valuable defectors and for extricating intelligence and extracting intelligence from false defectors and captured enemy agents. These requirements, in turn, produced a rapid expansion of research in the arcane activities of hypnotism and brainwashing techniques, mind control. This new field of unconventional warfare, like other sensitive operations, would eventually be hidden inside the CIA Security Research Staff, SRS. Morse Allen followed Robert Bannerman there from the State Department. And so once again, Morse Allen and Bob Bannerman were working together, this time in the dark arts of mind control to stop communist penetration of the U.S. In 1950, while working on Project Bluebird, Allen began experimenting with electroshocks to lull his subjects into a trance and testing the effects of radiation, temperature extremes, and ultrasonic noise. Eventually, Allen pioneered ways to induce amnesia to the point that his victims were reduced to a, quote, vegetable level, unquote. But Allen was particularly captivated with hypnosis. On 14 March 1951, the Inspection and Security Staff, ISS Chief Sheffield Edwards, met with the Assistant Directors of OPC, Office of Policy Coordination, and the Office of Special Operations, and the Office of Science Intelligence. Those present agreed on a proposal for Project Bluebird teams to utilize the polygraph, drugs, and hypnotism to achieve the greatest results in interrogation techniques. Edwards notified the relevant officers that all Bluebird documents within CIA had to be classified top secret and hand carried from one office to another on an eyes only basis. As KGBA spy wars intensified in 1952, Morse Allen carried out a very sensitive mission in Villeschuster, West Germany, small town just 3 miles from the westernmost crossing point into Czechoslovakia from Germany, and a perfect location for infiltration into communist territory on missions to kidnap agents and bring them back to Villeschuster for torture and interrogations. At Vila Schuster, Allen and his team tested, quote, dangerous combinations, unquote, of drugs on captured Russian prisoners, and his artichoke operations turned his victims into vegetables. The so-called research protocol for the project at Vila Schuster specified that disposing of the victims' bodies was, quote, not a problem, unquote. Many CIA players wanted a place at the table of this dark, covert field. From its inception, Project Bluebird Artichoke was the creation of Morse Allen. With his longtime obsession for hunting communists, Allen was the prime mover behind this project. He designed the CIA's hypnosis and drug-induced mind control protocols for the interrogation teams to protect the CIA in America against communist penetrations.
Okay, Dr. Newman, that concludes the second part of pre-record that we're going to show tonight, and I have a bunch of questions that came through in our chat log, so I will start off with a question here from Casey Quinlan. Did General Eisenhower, as Supreme Allied Commander, know anything of the financial corporations of the Dulles brothers and the Bush-Harriman banking systems that President Roosevelt took to his grave?
You know, I don't know the answer to that for certain, but I doubt it. That's all I can say about that. There's no evidence. I've looked at a lot. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of, some books are better than others, but some of the best ones I could find, I've never seen anything where most of those, even say British Alexander, General Alexander, these guys were pretty busy during World War II, commanding a huge amounts of forces. And so unless you were in the OSS on the civilian side of things like the Dulles brothers and others, I don't think you received very much information about it. So I'm going to say probably not.
Okay. Our next question comes from Larry Snaff. And it says, what relationship did Bill Harvey have with Gladio while he was Berlin section chief?
I don't believe there was too much going on in Gladio there, but by the time he got to Italy, it was different. Italy was, by that time, this is going to be 1963, right? Harvey was fired by RFK in 62, but Helms let him hide in the basement for a while. It was in the spring of 63 when he went to Italy, and there was a huge move to the right going on. And wouldn't you know that President Kennedy, after his speech to American University and the next night on TV talking about civil rights and how he wanted to change and do better things there, he goes to Italy in order to reach out to the left. And everybody indulged him and they gave him a band and a parade and all that. But he didn't know that what was actually taking place in the country at that time, and Harvey was in the middle of it, was a move towards the far right.
Okay, Dr. Newman. Our next question comes from Patrick McCarthy, and he asks the question here, wasn't Prescott Bush also one of the people who supported the unsuccessful, that's in parentheses, 1934 coup against FDR?
Yeah, I don't know about that. So I'll just have to pass on that because, I mean, I've heard about that, but I haven't read anything in most of the sources that I've been reading about that. So best thing to do is not say anything that was wrong talking about.
Okay, I have a question here from Tom. It says, how do we prove FDR planned to take care of Bush and Harriman after the war?
You know, you don't. And that's why I said he was walking a fine line. And he had his hand in the cookie jar in the interwar period. So technically, it's not a good thing. Everybody knew that Hitler wanted to do it again, and especially after after World War I, they took the Sudeten land away from them. So it was a sort of foregone conclusion. But anyway, Roosevelt had a lot of his own. Like I said, Harriman was one of them. A very visible guy, high up in the government, and he didn't stop him. And when the what they would call them, the non-investigator, there would be a when there would be an investigation, there was a person assigned to do that investigation. And it the particular title escapes me right now. But anyway, it turns out that what was happening is that there would be this investigation, but it would never be reported. This is what was going on with Roosevelt. So I have my doubts that even though he made some moves but he didn't do it publicly. And so it's all well and fine to say, I'm going to do it after the war. But it's like, you know, what happens if you hit your head in the bathtub or something? You know, nobody will ever know. So we can't prove that one way or the other. So I think that Roosevelt was playing both sides of the street.
Okay. I have a question here from Kit Burns. And it says, when did the Germans know they lost the war?
Oh, probably when Stalingrad on the one flank and Midway on the other. I think that's pretty much settled business. So we're talking about 42,
40, 43. Okay. Our next question comes from Eric Hamburg. And it says, could you talk about Howard Hunt's role in OSS?
No, not because I refuse to, because I don't know that much about it. So I know a lot about Hunt and some of the weird things he did, not good things, you know, that involved the Kennedys. But that's an interesting question. Eric Hamburg, if you're listening, I'm going to have to take a look at that.
Okay. Our next question, I saved this one because this is one of those three-question type of thing, so we have time. Let me start with the first one here. This is from Monty. It says, if Colonel Burris was a senior CIA focal point officer in Switzerland in the late 1950s, was he involved in deploying Lee Harvey Oswald to the USSR?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've looked into that, and it's possible because, you know, Oswald did go to allegedly went to Switzerland. And so but other than that, it's hard to show a very direct relationship. But there's probably something to it. I just haven't been able to – I haven't seen enough to get me interested in looking into that. But maybe I could be persuaded to do so if somebody could help me out.
Okay. Here's his part two. If Colonel Burris had advanced knowledge of false effectors like Oswald, does that mean Oswald was involved in long-range recognizance missions for joint intelligence operations like Gladio?
Could. It could. If A were true, then B could be true as well, right?
Right. And I'll go ahead and ask his last one here since I've already done the first two. And would it be reasonable to assume if Lee Harvey Oswald had stayed behind prepping the battlefield in Minsk, the heart of Nazi munitions factories during World War II, that Oswald used his tactical knowledge of infiltrating Soviet industry to conduct counter-surveillance prepping the site of President Kennedy's murder?
Well, I have the first chapter in Volume 4, which I haven't talked about publicly yet, is Oswald in the Soviet Union, and it's brand new stuff. It came out with the new releases in 17 and 18. And nobody paid any attention to it. And so the Minsk KGB school was the second largest KGB school in the Soviet Union. And they marched past Oswald's apartment every day. And they had a lot of interaction with him. And he did tell them a lot of things. They called him an agent that they'd recruited, but it's not going to be an agent in the sense of, you know, James Bond. Anyway, all of this information came out, it was not released publicly, but came into the possession of the CIA before the fall of the Soviet Union, a couple of years before the fall, unlike some of the things that we saw happen after the fall. And so that's the part I'm interested in. And the things that Oswald was doing, I think he was a flypaper. He was He was sent over there to attract KGB people who were not there, but in the United States, to ask more about him. All of his files, everything he did in the Soviet Union was suppressed inside of the CIA. I wrote about this all the way back in Oswald and the CIA, and Malcolm Blunt picked up on it, and we became sort of married at the hip for a number of years, trying to figure out internal distribution strategies. And that was what he was involved in. And he was very well rehearsed, which is well known and can be substantiated quite easily in the so-called defection scene in Moscow. And so I don't think he broke ranks and went outside of his what he was supposed to be doing. He was sent there to get them to think of him as somebody who knew about the U-2 program. The Soviet Union was absolutely livid with what we were doing. They couldn't shoot the U-2s down. So when you try and marry up that proposition and that question with all the other stuff that's coming out now, it's not a good fit, but I'm not saying it's impossible.
Okay. I'm supposed to ask you about the crypt, I.J. Decanter.
That's the source. That is the source of this new information. It's a funny story. There was a guy who walked in, I guess it was in one of the Scandinavian countries, into a CIA office, and said that he had lots of information showing that President Truman and President Eisenhower had masterminded the assassination of John Kennedy. And of course, that's ludicrous. So, and the ARV, as it was going out of existence, got a hold of this. And somebody who wasn't well known at the top of the ARV just saw this and looked into it and found that there was a source, another source, that said, this guy is full of crap. This is stupid. And he said a couple of things that were intriguing. And so the ARB analyst asked for more information from the CIA. And lo and behold, sometimes if you ask the CIA, they'll give it to you. And it was a happy day because this guy was on the level. He was a well-known source. His information was good. They gave him that crypt. The FBI wanted to get hold of him. They used Flash Run. It was their crypt for him. Anyway, I have an entire chapter on the IJ Decanter and Flash Run files and what contact Oswald had while he was at Minsk. And it was plenty of it. And so was Marina. They said she was a swallow, which was not a prostitute, but somebody who could be used for sexual favors, not for money, which on her side it would be to get a better apartment or something like that. But it involved dangling her possible sexual favors in front of people they wanted to find out more about. And so they were hopeful that when Oswald returned, that Marina would be an asset for them. Anyway, they found out that she married Oswald to get the hell out of there, and she had no intention of helping them out at all. But so anyway, that's all I'm prepared to say about IJ Decanter right now. I've got to work on that chapter pretty much more. But it's a fascinating thing that you would. I've heard people say, "Oh, there's nothing in those new releases." Well, you know, maybe not if it's not something you're looking for. But you know. If you go in with a broad net and take a look, and there was lots of stuff, you know, the whole Vestia thing, he was blown out of the water by all the stuff they released just 3 months after his book was published. I'm not talking about Vestia tonight. I've done enough of that for a long time. But I'm just saying the IJ Decanter stuff was part of what I think is high value in intelligence information fall of the Soviet Union, which makes it even more interesting. So I'm going to lead with that in volume four. It's going to be the first chapter.
And that's definitely why we're having the preview tonight of what is going to be coming up in Armageddon book four. And definitely we're going to be letting everybody know that's in our email list and also on our Journey show when your book comes out. And that comes out the end of the year, correct?
Yes. I'm trying everything I can to do it. So let's just set up the bridge at tomorrow. So basically, up to this point, counter-espionage is the big deal. It's the fulcrum and how well you do that through World War II and afterwards. But what happens, as everybody knows, suddenly, as Truman is only in there for a short while, he's the next, he's up, he's in the on-deck circle right now. Section 6 is the Truman administration. And it's nuclear weapons. Suddenly, in addition to counter-espionage and all that, we have now a new imperative, which is nuclear technology and what to do with it. And that's still going on today. But it's going to be a big part of the Truman and Eisenhower administrations. So far more interesting and far more disturbing than the information I've gone through tonight, going all the way. I just felt it was necessary to go all the way back to 1940 and start tracking these guys to see who were their mentors, who were their proteges, who did they hang out with. And I'll tell you, the thing that's different is the civilians versus the military, because the senior civilians were put into a position where mostly they stayed there. You know, the head of the CIA is always a civilian person. And so the CIA people, and the same thing in NSA where I worked for years, the civilians were there forever. But the military guys, there were military billets, they came in and out every 3 years, including all the way up to the director of the NSA. So what happens is you have civilian people stuck in a particular place, and you have these military guys, in senior ones, floating through all these organizations that have very, very sensitive information. And so they tend to know more. And we find out that's how the story ends. When we get into the Kennedy administration, the sum total of many, many years of that produces a small group or a couple of small groups of military intelligence. They're not intelligence officers, but they have access to high-level intelligence that knows a whole lot more than in many instances, than the CIA or the presidents. And that's what's getting ready to happen tomorrow night.
All right. And let's see here. I think we don't have any more questions in our chat log here. So always interesting to have you with us. And you're definitely a great guy to have your information and giving us the information that you have. So with that, we hope that you enjoyed our Spotlight series featuring Dr. Newman. Please be sure to join us tomorrow night at 6 p.m. Central Standard Time for the conclusion of the program, which will be very exciting. I've had the opportunity to be able to see pieces of it here. And I must say, it's going to be something you'll definitely want to tune into. If you wish to see the replay of tonight's event, minus the technical difficulties, or you know someone who missed it, it will be posted on our website, Project JFK, within the next 12 hours. So you'll be able to go back and see it and view it in its entirety. And then we'll have tomorrow night's video posted by Friday morning, so you'll be able to watch the entire thing if you wish. Anything else you'd like to add, Dr. Newman?
No, just my pleasure to be back with you guys again. I like what you're doing. We're always trying to invent as we go along what's happened, you know, not as a result of the pandemic, but it was happening anyway. It was getting old, you know, having to get on airplanes and buy hotel rooms to go to events when we could just do this, you know, and it's free. I'm glad you do that. And so I'm going to support you, and that's why I like working with you guys.
Well, we appreciate that. And we thank everybody that's in attendance tonight that showed up and joined us.
It's about 80 people. That's good.
Yeah, absolutely. So hopefully we'll have some more people show up tomorrow night, and they'll be able to catch the replay, and they'll be right on track with everybody. Yep. Okay, well, with that, I guess we're going to go ahead and close the meeting tonight, and we'll see everybody again tomorrow night at 6 p.m. Central Standard Time. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Dr. Newman.
Thank you.
you.